While we eat, we watch the latest Capitol News coverage. The government has the rebel survivors narrowed down to the five of us. Huge bounties are offered for information leading to our capture. They emphasize how dangerous we are, show us exchanging gunfire with the peacekeepers, although not the mutts ripping off their heads. Do a tragic tribute to the woman lying where we left her, with my arrow still in her heart. Someone has redone her makeup for the cameras. The rebels let the Capitol broadcast run on uninterrupted. Have the rebels made a statement today? I ask Tigress. She shakes her head. I doubt Coyne knows what to do with me now that I'm still alive. Tigress gives a throaty cackle.
No one knows what to do with you, girlie.
Then she makes me take a pair of the fur leggings, even though I can't pay her for them. It's the kind of gift you have to accept. And anyway, it's cold in that cellar. Downstairs, after supper, we continue to rack our brains for a plan. Nothing good comes up, but we do agree that we can no longer go out as a group of five, and that we should try to infiltrate the president's mansion before I turn myself into bait. I consent to that second point to avoid further argument. If I do decide to give myself up, it won't require anyone else's permission or participation. We change bandages, handcuff Peeta back to his support, and settle down to sleep. A few hours later, I slip back into consciousness and become aware of a quiet conversation. Peeta and Gale. I can't stop myself from eavesdropping.
Thanks for the water, Peeta says.
No problem, Gale replies. I wake up 10 times a night anyway.
To make sure Katniss is still here? Asks Peeta.
Something like that, Gale admits.
There's a long pause before Peeta speaks again.
That was funny, what Tigress said, about no one knowing what to do with her.
Well, we never have, Gale says.
They both laugh. It's so strange to hear them talking like this, almost like friends, which they're not, never have been, although they're not exactly enemies.
She loves you, you know, says Peeta. She's as good as told me after they whipped you.
Don't believe it, Gale answers. The way she kissed you in the quarter quell, well, she never kissed me like that.
It was just part of the show,
Peeta tells him, although there's an edge of doubt in his voice.
No, you won her over. Gave up everything for her. Maybe that's the only way to convince her you love her.
There's a long pause.
I should have volunteered to take your place in the first games. Protected her then.
You couldn't, says Peeta. She'd have never forgiven you. You had to take care of her family. They matter more to her than her life.
Well, it won't be an issue much longer. I think it's unlikely all three of us will be alive at the end of the war. And if we are, I guess it's Katniss's problem. Who to choose? Gale yawns. We should get some sleep.
Yeah.
I hear Peeta's handcuffs slide down the support as he settles in.
I wonder how she'll make up her mind.
Oh, that I do know.
I can just catch Gale's last words through the layer of fur.
Katniss will pick
whoever she thinks she can't survive without.
Chapter 24. A chill runs through me. Am I really that cold and calculating? Gale didn't say, Katniss will pick whoever it will break her heart to give up, or even whoever she can't live without. Those would have implied I was motivated by a kind of passion. But my best friend predicts I will choose the person who I think I can't survive without. There's not the least indication that love or desire or even compatibility will sway me. I'll just conduct an unfeeling assessment of what my potential mates can offer me, as if in the end it will be the question of whether a baker or a hunter will extend my longevity the most. It's a horrible thing for Gale to say, for Peeta not to refute.
especially when every emotion I have has been taken and exploited by the capital or the rebels. At the moment, the choice would be simple. I can survive just fine without either of them. In the morning, I have no time or energy to nurse wounded feelings. During a pre-dawn breakfast of liver pate and fig cookies, we gather around Tigris's television for one of Beatty's break-ins. There's been a new development in the war. Apparently inspired by the Black Wave, some enterprising rebel commander came up with the idea of confiscating people's abandoned automobiles and sending them unmanned down the streets. The cars don't trigger every pod, but they certainly get the majority. At around 4 in the morning, the rebels began carving 3 separate paths, simply referred to as the A, B, and C lines, to the capital's heart. As a result, they've secured block after block with very few casualties.
"This can't last," says Gale. "In fact, I'm surprised they've kept it going so long. The capital will adjust by deactivating specific pods and then manually triggering them when their targets come in range."
Almost within minutes of his prediction, we see this very thing happen on screen. A squad sends a car down a block, setting off 4 pods. All seems well. 3 scouts follow and make it safely to the end of the street. But when a group of 20 rebel soldiers follow them, they're blown to bits by a row of potted rose bushes in front of a flower shop.
"I bet it's killing Plutarch not to be in the control room on this one," says Peter.
Beatty gives the broadcast back to the Capitol, where a grim-faced reporter announces the blocks that civilians are to evacuate. Between her update and the previous story, I am able to mark my paper map to show the relative positions of the opposing armies. I hear scuffling out on the street, move to the windows, and peek out a crack in the shutters. In the early morning light, I see a bizarre spectacle. Refugees from the now occupied blocks are streaming toward the capital's center. The most panicked are wearing nothing but nightgowns and slippers, while the more prepared are heavily bundled in layers of clothes. They carry everything from lapdogs to jewelry boxes to potted plants. One man, in a fluffy robe, holds only an overripe banana. Confused, sleepy children stumble along after their parents, most either too stunned or too baffled to cry. Bits of them flash by my line of vision, a pair of wide brown eyes, an arm clutching a favorite doll, a pair of bare feet, bluish in the cold, catching on the uneven paving stones of the alley. Seeing them reminds me of the children of 12 who died fleeing the firebombs. I leave the window. Tigris offers to be our spy for the day, since she's the only one of us without a bounty on her head. After securing us downstairs, she goes out into the capital to pick up any helpful information. Down in the cellar, I pace back and forth, driving the others crazy. Something tells me that not taking advantage of the flood of refugees is a mistake. What better cover could we have? On the other hand, every displaced person milling about on the streets means another pair of eyes looking for the 5 rebels on the loose. Then again, what do we gain by staying here? All we're really doing is depleting our small cache of food and waiting for, what, the rebels to take the capital? It could be weeks before that happens, and I'm not so sure what I'd do if they did. Not run out and greet them. Coin would have me whisked back to 13 before I could say, "Nightlock, Nightlock, Nightlock." I did not come all this way and lose all those people to turn myself over to that woman. I kill Snow. Besides, there would be an awful lot of things I couldn't easily explain about the last few days, several of which, if they came to light, would probably blow my deal for the victor's immunity right out of the water. And forget about me. I've got a feeling some of the others are going to need it, like Peeta, who, no matter how you spin it, can be seen on tape tossing Mitchell into that net pod. I can imagine what Coyne's war tribunal will do with that.
By late afternoon, we're beginning to get uneasy about Tigress's long absence. Talk turns to the possibilities that she has been apprehended and arrested, turned us in voluntarily, or has simply been injured in the wave of refugees. But around 6 o'clock, we hear her return. There's some shuffling around upstairs, then she opens the panel. The wonderful smell of frying meat fills the air. Tigress has prepared us a hash of chopped ham and potatoes. It's the first hot food we've had in days, and as I wait for her to fill my plate, I'm in danger of actually drooling. As I chew, I try to pay attention to Tigress telling us how she acquired it, but the main thing I absorb is that fur underwear is a valuable trading item at the moment, especially for people who left their homes underdressed. Many are still out on the street trying to find shelter for the night. Those who live in the choice apartments of the inner city have not flung open their doors to house the displaced. On the contrary, most of them bolted their locks, drew their shutters, and pretended to be out. Now the city circles packed with refugees, and the peacekeepers are going door to door, breaking into places if they have to assign house guests. On the television, we watch a terse head peacekeeper lay out specific rules regarding how many people per square foot each resident will be expected to take in. He reminds the citizens of the capital that temperatures will drop well below freezing tonight and warns them that their president expects them to be not only willing but enthusiastic hosts in this time of crisis. Then they show some very staged-looking shots of concerned citizens welcoming grateful refugees into their homes. The head peacekeeper says the president himself has ordered part of his mansion readied to receive citizens tomorrow. He adds that shopkeepers should also be prepared to lend their floor space if requested.
"Tigress, that could be you," says Peeta.
I realize he's right, that even this narrow hallway of a shop could be appropriated as the numbers swell. Then we'll be truly trapped in the cellar, in constant danger of discovery. How many days do we have? 1? Maybe 2? The head peacekeeper comes back with more instructions for the population. It seems that this evening there was an unfortunate incident where a crowd beat to death a young man who resembled Peeta. Henceforth, all rebel sightings are to be reported immediately to authorities who will deal with the identification and arrest of the suspect. They show a photo of the victim. Apart from some obviously bleached curls, he looks about as much like Peeta as I do.
"People have gone wild," Cressida murmurs.
We watch a brief rebel update in which we learn that several more blocks have been taken today. I make note of the intersections on my map and study it.
"Line C is only 4 blocks from here," I announce.
Somehow that fills me with more anxiety than the idea of peacekeepers looking for housing. I become very helpful.
"Let me wash the dishes."
"I'll give you a hand."
Gail collects the plates. I feel Peeta's eyes follow us out of the room. In the cramped kitchen at the back of Tigress's shop, I fill the sink with hot water and suds.
"Do you think it's true," I ask, "that Snow will let refugees into the mansion?"
"I think he has to now, at least for the cameras," says Gail.
"I'm leaving in the morning," I say.
"I'm going with you," Gail says. "What should we do with the others?"
"Pollux and Cressida could be useful. They're good guides," I say.
Pollux and Cressida aren't actually the problem.
"But Peeta's too..."
"Unpredictable," finishes Gale. "Do you think he'd still let us leave him behind?"
"We can make the argument that he'll endanger us," I say. "He might stay here if we're convincing." Peeta's fairly rational about our suggestion. He readily agrees that his company could put the other 4 of us at risk. I'm thinking this may all work out, that he can just sit out the war in Tigress's cellar when he announces he's going out on his own.
"To do what?"
asks Cressida.
"I'm not sure exactly.
The one thing that I might still be useful at is causing a diversion. You saw what happened to the man who looked like me, he says.
What if you lose control? I say.
You mean go mutt? Well, if I feel that coming on, I'll try to get back here, he assures me.
And if snow gets you again? Asks Gale. You don't even have a gun.
I'll just have to take my chances, says Peeta, like the rest of you. The two exchange a long look, and then Gale reaches into his breast pocket. He places his nightlock tablet in Peeta's hand. Peeta lets it lay on his open palm, neither rejecting nor accepting it.
What about you?
Don't worry. Beatty showed me how to detonate my explosive arrows by hand. If that fails, I've got my knife, and I'll have Katniss, says Gale with a smile. She won't give them the satisfaction of taking me alive.
The thought of peacekeepers dragging Gale away starts the tune playing in my head again.
Are you coming to the tree?
Take it, Peeta, I say in a strained voice. I reach out and close his fingers over the pill. No one will be there to help you. We spend a fitful night, woken by one another's nightmares, minds buzzing with the next day's plans. I'm relieved when 5 o'clock rolls around and we can begin whatever this day holds for us. We eat a mishmash of our remaining food, canned peaches, crackers, and snails, leaving one can of salmon for Tigress as meager thanks for all she's done. The gesture seems to touch her in some way. Her face contorts in an odd expression, and she flies into action. She spends the next hour remaking the five of us. She redresses us so regular clothes hide our uniforms before we even don our coats and cloaks. Covers our military boots with some sort of furry slippers, secures our wigs with pins, cleans off the garish remains of the paint we so hastily applied to our faces, and makes us up again, drapes our outer wear to conceal our weapons. Then gives us handbags and bundles of knick-knacks to carry. In the end, we look exactly like the refugees fleeing the rebels.
Never underestimate the power of a brilliant stylist, says Peeta.
It's hard to tell, but I think Tigress might actually blush under her stripes. There are no helpful updates on the television, but the alley seems as thick with refugees as the previous morning. Our plan is to slip into the crowd in 3 groups. First, Cressida and Pollux, who will act as guides while keeping a safe lead on us. Then Gale and myself, who intend to position ourselves among the refugees assigned to the mansion today. Then Peeta, who will trail behind us, ready to create a disturbance as needed. Tigress watches through the shutters for the right moment, unbolts the door, and nods to Cressida and Pollux.
Take care, Cressida says, and they are gone.
We'll be following in a minute. I get out the key, unlock Peeta's cuffs, and stuff them in my pocket. He rubs his wrists, flexes them. I feel a kind of desperation rising up in me. It's like I'm back in the Quarter Quell, with Beatty giving Joanna and me that coil of wire.
Listen, I say, don't do anything foolish.
No, it's last resort stuff, completely, he says.
I wrap my arms around his neck, feel his arms hesitate before they embrace me. Not as steady as they once were, but still warm and strong. 1,000 moments surge through me. All the times these arms were my only refuge from the world, perhaps not fully appreciated then, but so sweet in my memory, and now gone forever.
All right, then.
I release him.
It's time, says Tigress.
I kiss her cheek, fasten my red hooded cloak, pull my scarf up over my nose, and follow Gale out into the frigid air. Sharp, icy snowflakes bite my exposed skin, the rising sun's trying to break through the gloom without much success. There's enough light to see the bundled forms closest to you and little more,
perfect conditions, really, except that I can't locate Cressida and Pollux. Gale and I drop our heads and shuffle along with the refugees. I can hear what I missed peeking through the shutters yesterday. Crying, moaning, labored breathing, and not too far away, gunfire.
"Where are we going, Uncle?"
a shivering little boy asks a man weighed down with a small safe.
"To the President's mansion. They'll assign us a new place to live," puffs the man.
We turn off the alley and spill out onto one of the main avenues.
"Stay to the right,"
a voice orders, and I see the peacekeepers interspersed throughout the crowd, directing the flow of human traffic. Scared faces peer out of the plate glass windows of the shops, which are already becoming overrun with refugees. At this rate, Tigris may have new house guests by lunch. It was good for everybody that we got out when we did. It's brighter now, even with the snow picking up. I catch sight of Cressida and Pollux about 30 yards ahead of us, plodding along with the crowd. I crane my head around to see if I can locate Peter. I can't, but I've caught the eye of an inquisitive-looking little girl in a lemon-yellow coat. I nudge Gale and slow my pace ever so slightly to allow a wall of people to form between us.
"We might need to split up," I say under my breath. "There's a girl."
Gunfire rips through the crowd, and several people near me slump to the ground. Screams pierce the air as a second barrage mows down another group behind us. Gale and I drop to the street, scuttle the 10 yards to the shops, and take cover behind a display of spike-heeled boots outside a shoe seller's. A row of feathery footwear blocks Gale's view.
"Who is it? Can you see?"
he asks me. What I can see, between alternating pairs of lavender and mint-green leather boots, is a street full of bodies. The little girl who was watching me kneels beside a motionless woman, screeching and trying to rouse her. Another wave of bullets slices across the chest of her yellow coat, staining it with red, knocking the girl onto her back. For a moment, looking at her tiny crumpled form, I lose my ability to form words. Gale prods me with his elbow.
"Katniss!"
"They're shooting from the roof above us," I tell Gale. I watch a few more rounds, see the white uniforms dropping into the snowy streets.
"Trying to take out the peacekeepers, but they're not exactly crack shots. It must be the rebels."
I don't feel a rush of joy, although theoretically my allies have broken through. I am transfixed by that lemon-yellow coat.
"If we start shooting, that's it," Gale says. "The whole world will know it's us."
It's true. We're armed only with our fabulous bows. To release an arrow would be like announcing to both sides that we're here.
"No,"
I say forcefully. "We've got to get to snow."
"Then we better start moving before the whole block goes up," says Gale.
Hugging the wall, we continue along the street. Only the wall is mostly shop windows, a pattern of sweaty palms and gaping faces press against glass. I yank my scarf up higher over my cheekbones as we dart between outdoor displays. Behind a rack of framed photos of snow, we encounter a wounded peacekeeper propped against a strip of brick wall. He asks us for help. Gale knees him in the side of the head and takes his gun. At the intersection, he shoots a second peacekeeper, and we both have firearms.
"So who are we supposed to be now?" I ask. "Desperate citizens of the capital," says Gale. "The peacekeepers will think we're on their side, and hopefully the rebels have more interesting targets."
I'm mulling over the wisdom of this latest role as we sprint across the intersection, but by the time we reach the next block, it no longer matters who we are, who anyone is, because no one is looking at faces. The rebels are here, all right, pouring onto the avenue, taking cover in doorways, behind vehicles, guns blazing, hoarse voices shouting commands as they prepare to meet an army of peacekeepers marching toward us. Caught in the crossfire are the refugees, unarmed, disoriented, many wounded. A pod's activated ahead of us, releasing a gush of steam that parboils everyone in its path, leaving the victims intestine pink and very dead. After that, what little sense of order there was unravels. As the remaining curlicues of steam intertwine with the snow, visibility extends just to the end of my barrel. Peacekeeper, rebel, citizen, who knows? Everything that moves is a target. People shoot reflexively, and I'm no exception. Heart pounding, adrenaline burning through me, everyone is my enemy, except Gale, my hunting partner, the one person who has my back. There's nothing to do but move forward, killing whoever comes into our path. Screaming people, bleeding people, dead people everywhere. As we reach the next corner, the entire block ahead of us lights up with a rich purple glow. We backpedal, hunker down in a stairwell, and squint into the light. Something's happening to those illuminated by it. They're assaulted by... what? A sound? A wave? A laser? Weapons fall from their hands, fingers clutch their faces, as blood sprays from all visible orifices, eyes, noses, mouths, ears. In less than a minute, everyone's dead, and the glow vanishes. I grit my teeth and run, leaping over the bodies, feet slipping in the gore. The wind whips the snow into blinding swirls, but doesn't block out the sound of another wave of boots headed our way. "Get down!" I hiss at Gale. We drop where we are. My face lands in a still warm pool of someone's blood, but I play dead, remain motionless as the boots march over us. Some avoid the bodies, others grind into my hand, my back, kick my head in passing. As the boots recede, I open my eyes and nod to Gale. On the next block, we encounter more terrified refugees, but few soldiers. Just when it seems we might have caught a break, there's a cracking sound, like an egg hitting the side of a bowl, but magnified 1,000 times. We stop, look around for the pod. There's nothing. Then I feel the tips of my boots beginning to tilt ever so slightly. "Run!" I cry to Gale. There's no time to explain, but in a few seconds the nature of the pod becomes clear to everyone. A seam has opened up down the center of the block. The two sides of the tiled street are folding down like flaps, slowly emptying the people into whatever lies beneath. I'm torn between making a beeline for the next intersection and trying to get to the doors that line the street and break my way into a building. As a result, I end up moving at a slight diagonal. As the flap continues to drop, I find my feet scrambling harder and harder to find purchase on the slippery tiles. It's like running along the side of an icy hill that gets steeper at every step. Both of my destinations, the intersection and the buildings, are a few feet away when I feel the flap going. There's nothing to do but use my last seconds of connection to the tiles to push off for the intersection. As my hands latch onto the side, I realize the flaps have swung straight down. My feet dangle in the air, no foothold anywhere. From 50 feet below, a vile stench hits my nose, like rotted corpses in the summer heat. Black forms crawl around in the shadows, silencing whoever survives the fall. A strangled cry comes from my throat. No one is coming to help me. I'm losing my grip on the icy ledge. When I see I'm only about 6 feet from the corner of the pod, I inch my hands along the ledge, trying to block out the terrifying sounds from below. When my hands straddle the corner, I swing my right boot up over the side. It catches on something, and I painstakingly drag myself up to street level. Panting, trembling, I crawl out and wrap my arm around a lamppost for an anchor, although the ground's perfectly flat. "Gale!" I call into the abyss, heedless of being recognized. "Gale!" "Over here!" I look in bewilderment to my left. The flap held up everything to the very base of the buildings.
A dozen or so people made it that far, and now hang from whatever provides a handhold. Doorknobs, knockers, mail slots. 3 doors down from me, Gale clings to the decorative iron grating around an apartment door. He could easily get inside if it was open, but despite repeated kicks to the door, no one comes to his aid. "Cover yourself!" I lift my gun. He turns away, and I drill the lock until the door flies inward. Gale swings into the doorway, landing in a heap on the floor. For a moment, I experience the elation of his rescue, then the white-gloved hands clamp down on him. Gale meets my eyes, mouths something at me I can't make out. I don't know what to do. I can't leave him, but I can't reach him either. His lips move again. I shake my head to indicate my confusion. At any minute, they'll realize who they've captured. The peacekeepers are hauling him inside now. "Go!" I hear him yell. I turn and run away from the pod. All alone now. Gale a prisoner. Cressida and Pollux could be dead 10 times over. And Peter? I haven't laid eyes on him since we left Tigress's. I hold on to the idea that he may have gone back, felt an attack coming, and retreated to the cellar while he still had control. Realized there was no need for a diversion when the capital has provided so many. No need to be bait and have to take the nightlock. The nightlock! Gale doesn't have any! And as for all that talk of detonating his arrows by hand, he'll never get the chance. The first thing the peacekeepers will do is to strip him of his weapons. I fall into a doorway, tears stinging my eyes. "Shoot me!" That's what he was mouthing. I was supposed to shoot him. That was my job. That was our unspoken promise, all of us, to one another. And I didn't do it, and now the capital will kill him, or torture him, or hijack him, or... The cracks begin opening inside me, threatening to break me into pieces. I have only one hope, that the capital falls, lays down its arms, and gives up its prisoners before they hurt Gale. But I can't see that happening while Snow's alive. A pair of peacekeepers runs by, barely glancing at the whimpering capital girl huddled in a doorway. I choke down my tears, wipe the existing ones off my face before they can freeze, and pull myself back together. Okay, I'm still an anonymous refugee. Or did the peacekeepers who caught Gale get a glimpse of me as I fled? I remove my cloak and turn it inside out, letting the black lining show instead of the red exterior. Arrange the hood so it conceals my face. Grasping my gun close to my chest, I survey the block. There's only a handful of dazed-looking stragglers. I trail close behind a pair of old men who take no notice of me. No one will expect me to be with old men. When we reach the end of the next intersection, they stop, and I almost bump into them. It's the city circle. Across the wide expanse, ringed by grand buildings, sits the president's mansion. The circle's full of people milling around, wailing, or just sitting and letting the snow pile up around them. I fit right in. I begin to weave my way across to the mansion, tripping over abandoned treasures and snow-frosted limbs. About halfway there, I become aware of the concrete barricade. It's about 4 feet high and extends in a large rectangle in front of the mansion. You would think it would be empty, but it's packed with refugees. Maybe this is the group that's been chosen to be sheltered at the mansion. But as I draw closer, I notice something else. Everyone inside the barricade is a child. Toddlers to teenagers, scared and frostbitten, huddled in groups or rocking numbly on the ground. They aren't being led into the mansion. They're penned in, guarded on all sides by peacekeepers. I know immediately it's not for their protection. If the capital wanted to safeguard them, they'd be down in a bunker somewhere. This is for Snow's protection. The children form his human shield. There's a commotion and the crowd surges to the left. I'm caught up by larger bodies borne sideways, carried off course.
I hear shouts of, "The rebels! The rebels!" And no, they must have broken through. The momentum slams me into a flagpole, and I cling to it. Using the rope that hangs from the top, I pull myself up out of the crush of bodies. Yes, I can see the rebel army pouring into the circle, driving the refugees back onto the avenues. I scan the area for the pods that will surely be detonating, but that doesn't happen. This is what happens. A hovercraft, marked with the capital seal, materializes directly over the barricaded children. Scores of silver parachutes rain down on them. Even in this chaos, the children know what silver parachutes contain. Food, medicine, gifts. They eagerly scoop them up, frozen fingers struggling with the strings. The hovercraft vanishes. 5 seconds pass. And then, about 20 parachutes simultaneously explode. A wail rises from the crowd. The snow's red and littered with undersized body parts. Many of the children die immediately, but others lie in agony on the ground. Some stagger around mutely, staring at the remaining silver parachutes in their hands, as if they still might have something precious inside. I can tell the peacekeepers didn't know this was coming by the way they are yanking away the barricades, making a path to the children. Another flock of white uniforms sweeps into the opening. But these aren't peacekeepers. They're medics. Rebel medics. I'd know the uniforms anywhere. They swarm in among the children, wielding medical kits. First, I get a glimpse of the blonde braid down her back. Then, as she yanks off her coat to cover a wailing child, I notice the ducktail formed by her untucked shirt. I have the same reaction I did the day Effie Trinket called her name at the reaping. At least I must go limp, because I find myself at the base of the flagpole, unable to account for the last few seconds. Then I am pushing through the crowd, just as I did before, trying to shout her name above the roar. I'm almost there, almost to the barricade, when I think she hears me, because for just a moment she catches sight of me. Her lips form my name. And that's when the rest of the parachutes go off. Chapter 25. Real or not real? I am on fire. The balls of flame that erupted from the parachutes shot over the barricades, through the snowy air, and landed in the crowd. I was just turning away when one caught me, ran its tongue up the back of my body, and transformed me into something new, a creature as unquenchable as the sun. A fire mutt knows only a single sensation. Agony. No sight, no sound, no feeling except the unrelenting burning of flesh. Perhaps there are periods of unconsciousness, but what can it matter if I can't find refuge in them? I am Cinna's bird, ignited, flying frantically to escape something inescapable, the feathers of flame that grow from my body, beating my wings only fans the blaze. I consume myself, but to no end. Finally, my wings begin to falter. I lose height, and gravity pulls me into a foamy sea the color of Phoenix eyes. I float on my back, which continues to burn beneath the water, but the agony quiets the pain. When I am adrift and unable to navigate, that's when they come. The dead. The ones I loved fly as birds in the open sky above me, soaring, weaving, calling to me to join them. I want so badly to follow them, but the seawater saturates my wings, making it impossible to lift them. The ones I hated have taken to the water, horrible scaled things that tear my salty flesh with needle teeth, biting again and again, dragging me beneath the surface. The small white bird, tinged in pink, dives down, buries her claws in my chest, and tries to keep me afloat.
No, Katniss, no, you can't go.
But the ones I hated are winning, and if she clings to me, she'll be lost as well. Prim, let go. And finally she does. Deep in the water, I'm deserted by all. There's only the sound of my breathing, the enormous effort it takes to draw the water in, push it out of my lungs. I want to stop. I try to hold my breath, but the sea forces its way in and out against my will. Let me die. Let me follow the others. I beg whatever holds me here. There's no response. Trapped for days, years, centuries maybe. Dead, but not allowed to die. Alive, but as good as dead. So alone that anyone, anything, no matter how loathsome, would be welcome. But when I finally have a visitor, it's sweet. Morphling, coursing through my veins, easing the pain, lightening my body so that it rises back toward the air and rests again on the foam. Foam. I really am floating on foam. I can feel it beneath the tips of my fingers, cradling parts of my naked body. There's much pain, but there's also something like reality. The sandpaper of my throat, the smell of burn medicine from the first arena, the sound of my mother's voice. These things frighten me. And I try to return to the deep to make sense of them, but there's no going back. Gradually, I'm forced to accept who I am. A badly burned girl with no wings, with no fire, and no sister. In the dazzling white Capitol Hospital, the doctors work their magic on me, draping my rawness in new sheets of skin, coaxing the cells into thinking they are my own, manipulating my body parts, bending and stretching the limbs to assure a good fit. I hear over and over again how lucky I am. My eyes were spared, most of my face was spared, my lungs are responding to treatment. I will be as good as new. When my tender skin has toughened enough to withstand the pressure of sheets, more visitors arrive. The morphling opens the door to the dead and alive alike. Haymitch, yellow and unsmiling. Cinna, stitching a new wedding dress. Deli, prattling on about the niceness of people. My father sings all four stanzas of The Hanging Tree and reminds me that my mother, who sleeps in a chair between shifts, isn't to know about it. One day, I awake to expectations and know I will not be allowed to live in my dreamland. I must take food by mouth, move my own muscles, make my way to the bathroom. A brief appearance by President Coyne clinches it.
"Don't worry," she says. "I've saved him for you."
The doctor's puzzlement grows over why I'm unable to speak. Many tests are done, and while there's damage to my vocal cords, it doesn't account for it. Finally, Dr. Aurelius, a head doctor, comes up with the theory that I've become a mental, rather than physical, AVOX, that my silence has been brought on by emotional trauma. Although he's presented with 100 proposed remedies, he tells them to leave me alone. So I don't ask about anyone or anything, but people bring me a steady stream of information. On the war, the Capitol fell the day the parachutes went off. President Coyne leads Panem now, and troops have been sent out to put down the small remaining pockets of Capitol resistance. On President Snow, he's being held prisoner, awaiting trial and most certain execution. On my assassination team, Cressida and Pollux have been sent out into the districts to cover the wreckage of the war. Gale, who took 2 bullets in an escape attempt, is mopping up peacekeepers in 2. Peeta's still in the burn unit. He made it to the city circle after all. On my family, my mother buries her grief in her work.
Having no work, grief buries me. All that keeps me going is Coin's promise that I can kill Snow, and when that's done, nothing will be left. Eventually, I'm released from the hospital and given a room in the president's mansion to share with my mother. She's almost never there, taking her meals and sleeping at work. It falls to Haymitch to check on me, make sure I'm eating and using my medicines. It's not an easy job. I take to my old habits from District 13, wandering unauthorized through the mansion, into bedrooms and offices, ballrooms and baths, seeking strange little hiding spaces, a closet of furs, a cabinet in the library, a long-forgotten bathtub in a room of discarded furniture. My places are dim and quiet and impossible to find. I curl up, make myself smaller, try to disappear entirely. Wrapped in silence. I slide my bracelet that reads, "Mentally Disoriented," around and around my wrist. My name is Katniss Everdeen. I'm 17 years old. My home is District 12. There is no District 12. I am the Mockingjay. I brought down the Capitol. President Snow hates me. He killed my sister. Now I will kill him. And then the Hunger Games will be over. Periodically I find myself back in my room, unsure whether I was driven by a need for morphling or if Haymitch ferreted me out. I eat the food, take the medicine, and am required to bathe. It's not the water I mind, but the mirror that reflects my naked fire-mutt body. The skin grafts still retain a newborn baby pinkness. The skin deemed damaged, but salvageable, looks red, hot, and melted in places. Patches of my former self gleam white and pale. I'm like a bizarre patchwork quilt of skin. Parts of my hair were singed off completely. The rest has been chopped off at odd lengths. Katniss Everdeen, the girl who was on fire. I wouldn't much care, except the sight of my body brings back the memory of the pain, and why I was in pain, and what happened just before the pain started, and how I watched my little sister become a human torch. Closing my eyes doesn't help. Fire burns brighter in the darkness. Dr. Aurelius shows up sometimes. I like him because he doesn't say stupid things like how I'm totally safe, or that he knows I can't see it, but I'll be happy again one day, or even that things will be better in Panem now. He just asks if I feel like talking, and when I don't answer, he falls asleep in his chair. In fact, I think his visits are largely motivated by his need for a nap. The arrangement works for both of us. The time draws near, although I could not give you exact hours and minutes. President Snow has been tried and found guilty, sentenced to execution, Haymitch tells me. I hear talk of it as I drift past the guards in the hallways. My Mockingjay suit arrives in my room. Also my bow, looking no worse for wear, but no sheath of arrows. Either because they were damaged, or more likely, because I shouldn't have weapons. I vaguely wonder if I should be preparing for the event in some way, but nothing comes to mind. Late one afternoon, after a long period in a cushioned window seat behind a painted screen, I emerge and turn left instead of right. I find myself in a strange part of the mansion and immediately lose my bearings. Unlike the area where I'm quartered, there seems to be no one around to ask. I like it, though. Wish I'd found it sooner. It's so quiet, with the thick carpets and heavy tapestries soaking up the sound. Softly lit, muted colors, peaceful. Until I smell the roses, I dive behind some curtains, shaking too hard to run, while I await the mutts. Finally, I realize there are no mutts coming. So, what do I smell? Real roses? Could it be that I am near the garden where the evil things grow? As I creep down the hall, the odor becomes overpowering, perhaps not as strong as the actual mutts, but purer, because it's not competing with sewage and explosives. I turn a corner and find myself staring at two surprised guards. Not peacekeepers, of course. There are no more peacekeepers. But not the trim gray-uniformed soldiers from 13, either. These two, a man and a woman, wear the tattered, thrown-together clothes of actual rebels. Still bandaged and gaunt, they are now keeping watch over the doorway to the roses. When I move to enter, their guns form an X in front of me.
"You can't go in, miss," says the man.
"Soldier," the woman corrects him.
"You can't go in, Soldier Everdeen. President's orders."
I just stand there patiently waiting for them to lower their guns, for them to understand, without my telling them, that behind those doors is something I need. Just a rose, a single bloom, to place in Snow's lapel before I shoot him. My presence seems to worry the guards. They're discussing calling Haymitch when a woman speaks up behind me.
"Let her go in."
I know the voice, but can't immediately place it. Not Seam, not 13, definitely not Capital. I turn my head and find myself face to face with Paler, the commander from 8. She looks even more beat up than she did at the hospital, but who doesn't?
"On my authority," says Paler,
"she has a right to anything behind that door." These are her soldiers, not coins. They drop their weapons without question and let me pass. At the end of a short hallway, I push apart the glass doors and step inside. By now the smell's so strong that it begins to flatten out, as if there's no more my nose can absorb. The damp, mild air feels good on my hot skin, and the roses are glorious. Row after row of sumptuous blooms in lush pink, sunset orange, and even pale blue. I wander through the aisles of carefully pruned plants, looking but not touching, because I have learned the hard way how deadly these beauties can be. I know when I find it, crowning the top of a slender bush, a magnificent white bud just beginning to open. I pull my left sleeve over my hand so that my skin won't actually have to touch it, take up a pair of pruning shears, and have just positioned them on the stem when he speaks.
"That's a nice one."
My hand jerks. The shears snap shut, severing the stem. The colors are lovely, of course, but nothing says perfection like white. I still can't see him, but his voice seems to rise up from an adjacent bed of red roses. Delicately pinching the stem of the bud through the fabric of my sleeve, I move slowly around the corner and find him sitting on a stool against the wall. He's as well-groomed and finely dressed as ever, but weighted down with manacles, ankle shackles, tracking devices. In the bright light, his skin's a pale, sickly green. He holds a white handkerchief spotted with fresh blood. Even in his deteriorated state, his snake eyes shine bright and cold.
"I was hoping you'd find your way to my quarters."
His quarters? I have trespassed into his home, the way he slithered into mine last year, hissing threats with his bloody, rosy breath. This greenhouse is one of his rooms, perhaps his favorite, perhaps in better times he tended the plants himself, but now it's part of his prison. That's why the guards halted me, and that's why Paler let me in. I'd supposed he would be secured in the deepest dungeon that the capital had to offer, not cradled in the lap of luxury. Yet Coyne left him here, to set a precedent, I guess, so that if in the future she ever fell from grace, it would be understood that presidents, even the most despicable, get special treatment. Who knows, after all, when her own power might fade.
"There are so many things we should discuss, but I have a feeling your visit will be brief.
So, first things first.
He begins to cough, and when he removes the handkerchief from his mouth, it's redder.
I wanted to tell you how very sorry I am about your sister.
Even in my deadened, drugged condition, this sends a stab of pain through me, reminding me that there are no limits to his cruelty, and how he will go to his grave trying to destroy me.
So wasteful, so unnecessary. Anyone could see the game was over by that point. In fact, I was just about to issue an official surrender when they released those parachutes.
His eyes are glued on me, unblinking, so as not to miss a second of my reaction. But what he's said makes no sense. When they released the parachutes...
Well, you really didn't think I gave the order, did you? Forget the obvious fact, that if I'd had a working hovercraft at my disposal, I'd have been using it to make an escape. But that aside, what purpose could it have served? We both know I'm not above killing children, but I'm not wasteful. I take life for very specific reasons, and there was no reason for me to destroy a pen full of capital children. None at all.
I wonder if the next fit of coughing is staged so that I can have time to absorb his words. He's lying. Of course he's lying. But there's something struggling to free itself from the lie as well.
However, I must concede it was a masterful move on Coyne's part. The idea that I was bombing our own helpless children instantly snapped whatever frail allegiance my people still felt to me. There was no real resistance after that. Did you know it aired live? You can see Plutarch's hand there, and in the parachutes. Well, it's that sort of thinking that you look for in a head game maker, isn't it?
Snow dabs the corners of his mouth.
I'm sure he wasn't gunning for your sister, but these things happen.
I'm not with Snow now. I'm in special weaponry, back in 13 with Gale and Beatty, looking at the designs based on Gale's traps that played on human sympathies. The first bomb killed the victims, the second, the rescuers. Remembering Gale's words, Beatty and I have been following the same rulebook President Snow used when he hijacked PETA.
My failure, says Snow, was being so slow to grasp Coyne's plan. To let the capital and districts destroy one another and then step in to take power with 13 barely scratched. Make no mistake, she was intending to take my place right from the beginning. I shouldn't be surprised. After all, it was 13 that started the rebellion that led to the Dark Days, and then abandoned the rest of the districts when the tide turned against it. But I wasn't watching Coyne. I was watching you, Mockingjay. And you were watching me. I'm afraid we have both been played for fools.
I refuse for this to be true. Some things even I can't survive. I utter my first words since my sister's death. I don't believe you. Snow shakes his head in mock disappointment.
Oh, my dear Miss Everdeen, I thought we had agreed not to lie to each other.
Chapter 26. Out in the hall, I find Paler standing in exactly the same spot.
Did you find what you were looking for?
She asks. I hold up the white bud in answer, and then stumble past her. I must have made it back to my room, because the next thing I know, I'm filling a glass with water from the bathroom faucet and sticking the rose in it. I sink to my knees on the cold tile and squint at the flower, as the whiteness seems hard to focus on in the stark fluorescent light. My finger catches the inside of my bracelet, twisting it like a tourniquet, hurting my wrist. I'm hoping the pain will help me hang on to reality the way it did for PETA. I must hang on,
I must know the truth about what has happened.
There are two possibilities, although the details associated with them may vary. First, as I believed, that the capital sent in that hovercraft, dropped the parachutes, and sacrificed their children's lives, knowing the recently arrived rebels would go to their aid. There's evidence to support this, the capital's seal on the hovercraft, the lack of any attempt to blow the enemy out of the sky, and their long history of using children as pawns in their battle against the districts. Then there's Snow's account, that a capital hovercraft, manned by rebels, bombed the children to bring a speedy end to the war. But if this was the case, why didn't the capital fire on the enemy? Did the element of surprise throw them? Had they no defenses left? Children are precious to 13, or so it has always seemed. Well, not me, maybe. Once I had outlived my usefulness, I was expendable, although I think it's been a long time since I've been considered a child in this war. And why would they do it, knowing their own medics would likely respond and be taken out by the second blast? They wouldn't. They couldn't. Snow's lying, manipulating me as he always has, hoping to turn me against the rebels and possibly destroy them. Yes, of course. Then what's nagging at me?
Those double-exploding bombs, for one. It's not that the capital couldn't have the same weapon. It's just that I'm sure the rebels did. Gale and Beatty's brainchild. Then there's the fact that Snow made no escape attempt, when I know him to be the consummate survivor. It seems hard to believe he didn't have a retreat somewhere, some bunker stocked with provisions where he could live out the rest of his snaky little life. And finally, there's his assessment of Coyne. What's irrefutable is that she's done exactly what he said. Let the capital and the districts run one another into the ground and then sauntered in to take power. Even if that was her plan, it doesn't mean she dropped those parachutes. Victory was already in her grasp. Everything was in her grasp. Except me. I recall Boggs's response when I admitted I hadn't put much thought into Snow's successor.
If your immediate answer isn't Coyne, then you're a threat. You're the face of the rebellion. You may have more influence than any other single person. Outwardly, the most you've ever done is tolerated her.
Suddenly I'm thinking of Prim, who was not yet 14, not yet old enough to be granted the title of soldier, but somehow working on the front lines. How did such a thing happen? That my sister would have wanted to be there, I have no doubt. That she would be more capable than many older than she is a given. But for all that, someone very high up would have had to approve putting a 13-year-old in combat. Did Coyne do it, hoping that losing Prim would push me completely over the edge? Or at least firmly on her side? I wouldn't even have had to witness it in person. Numerous cameras would be covering the city circle, capturing the moment forever. No, now I am going crazy, slipping into some state of paranoia. Too many people would know of the mission. Word would get out. Or would it? Who would have to know besides Coyne, Plutarch, and a small loyal or easily disposable crew? I badly need help working this out, only everyone I trust is dead. Cinna, Boggs, Finnick, Prim. There's Peter, but he couldn't do any more than speculate, and who knows what state his mind's in anyway. And that leaves only Gale. He's far away, but even if he were beside me, could I confide in him? What could I say? How could I phrase it without implying that it was his bomb that killed Prim? The impossibility of that idea, more than any, is why Snow must be lying. Ultimately, there's only one person to turn to who might know what happened and might still be on my side. To broach the subject at all will be a risk, but while I think Haymitch might gamble with my life in the arena, I don't think he'd rat me out to Coyne.
Whatever problems we may have with each other, we prefer resolving our differences one-on-one. I scramble off the tiles, out the door, and across the hall to his room. When there's no response to my knock, I push inside. Ugh! It's amazing how quickly he can defile a space. Half-eaten plates of food, shattered liquor bottles, and pieces of broken furniture from a drunken rampage scatter his quarters. He lies, unkempt and unwashed, in a tangle of sheets on the bed, passed out. "Hamish!" I say, shaking his leg. Of course, that's insufficient. But I give it a few more tries before I dump the pitcher of water in his face. He comes to with a gasp, slashing blindly with his knife. Apparently, the end of Snow's reign didn't equal the end of his terror.
"Oh, you," he says.
I can tell by his voice that he's still loaded. "Hamish," I begin.
"Listen to that. The Mockingjay found her voice."
He laughs.
"Well, Plutarch's going to be happy."
He takes a swig from a bottle.
"Why am I soaking wet?"
I lamely drop the pitcher behind me into a pile of dirty clothes. "I need your help," I say. Hamish belches, filling the air with white liquor fumes.
"What is it, sweetheart? More boy trouble?"
I don't know why, but this hurts me in a way Hamish rarely can. It must show on my face, because even in his drunken state, he tries to take it back.
"Okay, not funny."
I'm already at the door.
"Not funny, come back."
By the thud of his body hitting the floor, I assume he tried to follow me, but there's no point. I zigzag through the mansion and disappear into a wardrobe full of silken things. I yank them from hangers until I have a pile, and then burrow into it. In the lining of my pocket, I find a stray morphling tablet and swallow it dry, heading off my rising hysteria. It's not enough to write things, though. I hear Hamish calling me in the distance, but he won't find me in his condition, especially not in this new spot. Swathed in silk, I feel like a caterpillar in a cocoon awaiting metamorphosis. I always supposed that to be a peaceful condition. At first it is, but as I journey into night, I feel more and more trapped, suffocated by the slippery bindings, unable to emerge until I have transformed into something of beauty. I squirm, trying to shed my ruined body and unlock the secret to growing flawless wings. Despite enormous effort, I remain a hideous creature, fired into my current form by the blast from the bombs. The encounter with Snow opens the door to my old repertoire of nightmares. It's like being stung by tracker-jackers again. A wave of horrifying images, with a brief respite I confuse with waking, only to find another wave knocking me back. When the guards finally locate me, I'm sitting on the floor of the wardrobe, tangled in silk, screaming my head off. I fight them at first, until they convince me they're trying to help, peel away the choking garments, and escort me back to my room. On the way, we pass a window, and I see a gray, snowy dawn spreading across the capital. A very hungover Hamish waits with a handful of pills and a tray of food that neither of us has the stomach for. He makes a feeble attempt to get me to talk again, but seeing it's pointless, sends me to a bath someone has drawn. The tub's deep, with three steps to the bottom. I ease down into the warm water and sit, up to my neck in suds, hoping the medicines kick in soon. My eyes focus on the rose that has spread its petals overnight, filling the steamy air with its strong perfume. I rise and reach for a towel to smother it when there's a tentative knock and the bathroom door opens, revealing three familiar faces. They try to smile at me, but even Venia can't conceal her shock at my ravaged, mutt body.
"Surprise!"
Octavia squeaks, and then bursts into tears. I'm puzzling over their reappearance when I realize that this must be it, the day of the execution. They've come to prep me for the cameras, remake me to Beauty Base Zero. No wonder Octavia's crying. It's an impossible task. They can barely touch my patchwork of skin for fear of hurting me, so I rinse and dry off myself. I tell them I hardly notice the pain anymore, but Flavia still winces as he drapes a robe around me. In the bedroom, I find another surprise. Sitting upright in a chair, polished from her metallic gold wig to her patent leather high heels, gripping a clipboard. Remarkably unchanged, except for the vacant look in her eyes.
"Effie," I say.
"Hello, Katniss." She stands and kisses me on the cheek, as if nothing has occurred since our last meeting, the night before the Quarter Quell.
"Well, it looks like we've got another big, big, big day ahead of us, so why don't you start your prep and I'll just pop over and check on the arrangements."
"Okay," I say to her back.
"They say Plutarch and Haymitch had a hard time keeping her alive," comments Venia under her breath. "She was imprisoned after your escape, so that helps."
"It's quite a stretch. Effie Trinket, rebel. But I don't want Coin killing her, so I make a mental note to present her that way if asked. I guess it's good Plutarch kidnapped you three after all.
We're the only prep team still alive, and all the stylists from the Quarter Quell are dead," says Venia.
She doesn't say who specifically killed them. I'm beginning to wonder if it matters. She gingerly takes one of my scarred hands and holds it out for inspection.
"Now, what do you think for the nails? Red, or maybe a jet black?"
Flavius performs some beauty miracle on my hair, managing to even out the front while getting some of the longer locks to hide the bald spots in the back. My face, since it was spared from the flames, presents no more than the usual challenges. Once I'm in Cinna's Mockingjay suit, the only scars visible are on my neck, forearms, and hands. Octavia secures my Mockingjay pin over my heart, and we step back to look in the mirror. I can't believe how normal they've made me look on the outside when inwardly I'm such a wasteland. There's a tap at the door, and Gale steps in.